one spoke. The only sound in the room was the soft shuffle of feet as the other men in the bar began to back away out of the line of fire. Unhurriedly, Biggles turned the reflective eye on McBain, who was now holding a glass in one hand, while the revolver, an almost imperceptible coil of smoke creeping from the muzzle, and the bottle of whiskey rested on the bar in front of him. "Give me another drink, boss, will you?" requested Biggles quietly, and put his hand in his pocket as if to take out the money to pay for it. McBain stood his glass on the bar. His hand moved towards the revolver, but on this occasion things did not go in accordance with his plan. Biggles' hand jerked out of his pocket. There was a double report, the two shots coming so close together they almost sounded like one. There was a crash of shattering glass, and a metallic ping as McBain's bottle of whiskey splintered into 100 pieces, and his revolver spun along the polished bar before falling behind it. "What's the matter, McBain?" asked Biggles evenly. "Any fool can play a game single-handed. You don't mind me joining in, surely?" Biggles addressed the barkeeper. "What is the usual procedure in a case like this, in this part of the world?" he inquired. "Do I shoot him?"
"Hey, wait a minute," snapped the bartender. "I don't want no shooting here."
"I didn't start it," Biggles pointed out.
"No, I know you didn't."
"I'd better plug him and rid the world of a dirty beast," suggested Biggles, wondering at the back of his mind why McBain's friends did not take a hand. Snatching a glance in their direction, he understood. Ginger's automatic was covering them. How the matter would have ended, it's impossible to say, but at that moment the outside door was flung open, and Delaney the police constable stood on the threshold, a carbine in his hands.
"What's the shooting?"
inquired bluntly. "Only me and McBain, seeing who can spill most liquor," replied Biggles.
"You two at it again?"
The constable's eyes went from one to the other.
"Who pulled first?" he demanded.
"McBain! He shot his drink!"
shouted old Mose shrilly.
"I've seen it!"
"Any more shooting between you two, and I'll throw you both in jail," declared the constable.
"Quite right," murmured Biggles, putting his automatic back in his pocket. "Come on, Ginger, grab these supplies and let's be going." As they went out, Biggles nodded to Mose. "See you at daybreak," he called. Then the door closed behind them, and they hurried back to the aerodrome. On their return to the hangar, Biggles reported the shooting incident in full to Wilkes. "But what's more important," he continued quickly, "we've got on the track of Angus Sterling. He's working a claim up north on Eskimo Island with an old fellow named Mose. Mose is here in Fort Beaver collecting winter stores, and Angus sent a message to you to the effect that he's got the land transfer. You can have it when you want." Wilkes sprang to his feet.
"Who's that in our possession? We can give McBain his marching orders."
Biggles nodded. "That's the way I see it. So I've arranged to fly Mose back to the claim tomorrow. We'll land first at Moose Creek, where I'll dump the freight for the gold people. Mose will meet us here at dawn." A shadow of anxiety crossed Wilkes's face.
"He said McBain was there," he muttered. "If he knows about this, he may try to stop Mose."
"Well, I think he knows, but I don't see what he can do," answered Biggles thoughtfully. "Anyway, all we want tomorrow is a fine day. Algy and Smith should be back with the other machine, and the next day we should be back with the transfer. Then we'll see what McBain has to say. I wonder what the weather's doing." "I'll go and have a look," offered Ginger, and leaving the table, walked slowly out of the hangar door. 20 minutes later, Ginger had not returned. The others were just starting out to look for him when suddenly he burst through the door. "Where the dickens have you been?" snapped Biggles tersely. Ginger's manner was abrupt as he waved them back to the table. "I've been indulging in a very questionable pastime. Some people might call it eavesdropping, but in time of war like this, the best people call it scouting. I've been listening in at McBain's hut across the field. McBain himself wasn't there at first, but he arrived later, looking somewhat agitated, I may add. But Wilkes, if you think those guys are here simply to run you off your aerodrome, you're wrong." There was a moment's silence. "What are they after?" Biggles almost hissed the words. Ginger drained a cup of cold coffee before replying. "Gold," he said quickly. "The little bags of yellow metal from Moose Creek." Wilkes nodded slowly.
"Oh, kick me, somebody," he said weakly. "I never even thought of that."
The stars were still twinkling in the sky when, the following morning, Biggles, Wilkes and Ginger pulled the Jupiter out of the shed. While they were waiting for Mose, they discussed the new aspect of Ginger's scouting expedition the previous night. It would be no use telling Delaney without proof, remarked Biggles quietly. He'd think that we were just shooting a cock-and-bull story to put McBain and Co. under suspicion.
How about warning the people at Moose Creek, suggested Wilkes.
They'd be less likely to believe us than Delaney, declared Biggles. They would think of a scheme to put McBain out of the airline business. They might even tell McBain we'd reported them as crooks. Then we'd never be able to expose him. No, at this juncture we say nothing to anybody.
Biggles glanced at his wristwatch as he finished speaking.
Well, Mose is late, he observed. Who's this coming? Asked Ginger, staring in the direction of the village. Looks like Delaney. Yes, it is him, declared Biggles.
A minute later, the Mountie pulled up his horse and dismounted beside the waiting airman. His eyes rested on Biggles' face.
Where did you go after you left the 3-star last night? He asked crisply.
Biggles raised his eyebrows. Ginger and I came straight back here. Wilkes can verify when we got back. What's this all about, anyway?
What were you three standing here for when I came along? You looked as if you were expecting somebody.
We were, agreed Biggles. We'd arranged to fly Angus Sterling's partner, Mose, back to their claim.
Between ourselves, Delaney, Angus has got the transfer for this property. If we get it, we can give McBain the run-along.
Well, Mose won't be coming, said the constable slowly. He's dead.
Biggles paled.
Dead? He cried incredulously. Why, he was as right as rain last night.
No doubt he would have been this morning, too. Someone hadn't clubbed his brains up.
You mean he was murdered?
People don't beat their own brains out.
Biggles' mind raced as he tried to focus the situation in its new aspect.
Well, we have nothing to gain by his death, he pointed out. We want that transfer badly.
My gosh, things look bad for Angus. Mose was taking up their winter grub.
If Angus is somewhere on Eskimo Island, he'll be snowed in for 6 months come the freeze-up.
He'll starve, said Delaney.
I'll take the grub up, stated Biggles.
Then you've no time to waste, said Delaney harshly. The snow's on the way, but one of you stay here, in case I want you. I'll go and have a word with McBain.
With a curt nod, the constable led his horse towards McBain's shed, where McBain himself and his crew were now pulling an aeroplane from the hangar. As soon as Delaney was out of earshot, Ginger swung round to Biggles.
McBain must have killed him, he whispered tensely. Remember, last night. I told you he came in when I was eavesdropping, very late and very agitated. He must have done it.
I wonder, murmured Biggles. Well, if he did, he certainly had a motive.
By killing the old man, he might have reckoned on stopping us making contact with Angus.
Question is, does McBain know that we know Angus is on Eskimo Island? There's no use guessing, anyway. The first thing we've got to do is get poor old Moses Grubsteak up here, then to Angus, if we can find him.
The business of fetching Angus's winter supplies occupied some time, for it meant a journey to the village. By the time Biggles and Ginger got back to the aerodrome, Delaney had gone. So had one of McBain's Wankel 12 transports.
It took off about 20 minutes ago, explained Wilkes. Headed north with Sarton flying and Chico alongside.
Biggles nodded and climbed into the cabin of the Jupiter.
En route to Moose Creek, Biggles roared low over Wilkes's Rockheed, but receiving an okay signal from Algy, he did not land. Biggles tilted the Jupiter's nose upwards as he climbed to his original height and settled down for the long journey to Moose Creek. The sun was hanging low over the western mountains when Biggles saw what he knew must be the goldfield. On the banks of a wide creek were clustered a number of huts with corrugated iron roofs. Near them, the ground was flat, and as they glided down, they were able to discern wheel tracks, indicating where machines usually landed. The place could hardly be called an aerodrome. In 10 minutes, they had taxied up to the buildings, where a man in a fur jacket was waiting for them.
Are you Canwell? Called Biggles,
guessing it was the traffic manager.
No, you said it, was the curt reply. You seen anything of Wilkinson?
Yes, I'm his new partner. I brought your stuff along.
Oh, about time, too.
We had some trouble, but we're all set now for regular service, Biggles promised him.
Canwell blew a whistle, at which some men appeared and began unloading the equipment.
I've just had one of McBean's machines here, he told Biggles.
It struck Biggles as odd that they hadn't seen the Wankel on its homeward journey. but he didn't comment on it.
What did they want, sir? He inquired.
They offered to carry all my stuff at 15 cents a pound.
Biggles was taken aback at this cut rate, but his face remained expressionless. I'll do it at 12 cents.
Sounds fair to me, said Canwell. I aim to have a shipment box ready for tomorrow, so you can take it. You'll be staying here tonight?
Biggles looked at the sun.
Well, how much daylight have I got left? About a week to 10 days, I reckon.
Enlightenment burst upon Biggles. He realized they were so far north that the sun did not drop below the horizon until it went for good in the long winter months.
Of course, the midnight sun, he exclaimed.
How far is it to Eskimo Island?
Oh, about 500 miles due north.
Good. We can make it there and back in time.
Canwell's eyes narrowed.
Whatever happens, that metal has got to go to Fort Beaver tomorrow.
You mean if I'm not here, then McBain takes it?
That's precisely what I mean.
See you tomorrow.
Biggles and Ginger climbed into their seats to resume the flight northward.
The thing that beats me, muttered Biggles as he started the engines, is how Sarton got back without us seeing him.
He might have gone on to where we're going, suggested Ginger. Biggles started.
Gosh, I never thought of that.
A minute or two later, the big machine was nosing up in the sky, which had taken on a dull, leaden hue.
Look at that, remarked Biggles. It's going to snow before long, and when it starts, it'll snow for a long, long time.
Ginger shivered suddenly, conscious of a terrifying solitude. He was about to remark on this to Biggles when a sound reached his ears that caused every muscle in his body to stiffen. He knew what it was immediately. It was the unmistakable rattle of a machine gun. Before he could even move, the sound came again, this time much more distinctly, and simultaneously the Jupiter quivered as if it had been struck by a cat of nine tails. Ginger's throat turned dry, and the next instant he was clinging desperately to his seat as the Jupiter soared upwards in a wild, climbing turn. Bracing himself against the side of the cabin, he looked out of the window, just in time to see a Wankel transport go tearing past. The window nearest to him was open, and from it projected what appeared to be a short black stick, at the end of which danced a vicious streak of flame.